Welcome to You Can Win in Court. Sometimes it's not enough to be innocent. The legal system is complex, and occasionally, the innocent are wrongly accused. Here we will discuss, in layman's terms, the nuances from real court cases to provide insights on how you can best prepare to get a fair chance in court. And now, please welcome your host, Dr. Petra Dieter.
Welcome, and today we are going to be talking about business litigation. And with us today, we have Greg Brown from Brown and Chabanneau Partnerships. Hi, Greg. How are you?
Great. How are you doing today?
Thank you so much for being here today. So we are talking about business litigation. What kind of cases are you seeing in this area of the law?
Typically, we see a lot of different cases. Most recently, we've been seeing a lot of partnership disputes and shareholder disputes between the various owners of businesses. A lot of times it involves a breach of fiduciary duty, fraud, breach of contract, those types of cases. I have one case right now where they're arguing over the percentage of ownership, but they're also arguing about how the company should be run and where the money should be spent. It can be a number of things. Some are, people are doing self-dealing, or they set up a competing company that's hurting the corporation or the partnership. They're defrauding their partners, all kinds of things.
Oh, I understand. And the thing is, it doesn't matter what kind of contract you may have had at the beginning, it's impossible to define exactly how the business should run as it goes on, right? So,
but yeah, if there is no contract, that makes things a lot more difficult. So for purposes of a partnership, we would look for a partnership agreement to outline the specific duties, obligations, and rights of the various parties. If it's a corporation, typically you would see a shareholder buy-sell agreement. But in either case, if we don't have anything in writing, it makes it much more difficult, because then you have to look to all kinds of other things like emails or documents from 20 years ago, and it leaves a lot of room for fighting.
And deposition is when you interview the witness before trial and record that, or?
Yes, a deposition is, it's just like testifying in court. It holds the same force and effect. So, let's say I wanted to depose the plaintiff on a case for the other side. Before COVID, that person would come to our office and I'd have a court reporter there and swear them in, and they'd have to testify under oath. I would be able to use that testimony at trial. If they then change their testimony and say something different at trial, then I would read to the jury or to the judge, hey, this is what they said, 8 months ago at their deposition. Here today they say yes, but back then they said no. And I would use that to show that maybe they're not credible witnesses, or they're, testifying falsely. That's how we use it. And then some instances, if there's a potential that we won't, let's say, for example, we have an elderly witness that I'm deposing. If there's any chance that I think that they may not make it all the way to trial, or if there's other reasons that we want to preserve their testimony, we'll videotape it and use the video at trial. So if, in some instances, if we think a witness is probably going to have a tough time telling the truth in the deposition, we may videotape it to try and catch them unprepared and catch them lying via video, or their demeanor, if they're squirming in their seat, or if they're looking up, to the heavens for their answer, or if they're looking over to their lawyer and looking for help from the lawyer, that all shows up on a video, and that can be used against them to attack their credibility.
I see. And you mentioned about jury. So is it always a jury trial, or is it sometime a judge?
No, sometimes it's just a judge trial. So for the most part, the parties to a business litigation case can choose whether to go with a jury or a judge. And if the case is entitled to have a jury, it only takes one side to demand a jury, and it has to be a jury trial. There are certain types of cases, like a shareholder derivative action, which is kind of like a shareholder's dispute, but the corporation becomes a party to the lawsuit. Another podcast, maybe. But in those instances, you don't get a jury trial. So shareholder derivative actions are jury trials. I mean, are bench trials, not jury trials. But everyone has a right to a jury on all the cases that, the types of cases that allow for a jury. For example, in family law cases, in divorces, there's no jury there. So business disputes, contract, fraud, breach of fiduciary duty, personal injury, all those kinds of cases, everyone has a right to a jury.
So what about, we're talking about business disputes. So what about personal dispute? Like, let's say you and I, it's not about business, but we are friends, and then we later argue about who borrows the other person money. Is that also a potential jury case?
Yes, yes. So if that was a breach of contract case between two individuals, let's say two next door neighbors, guy says, I'll sell you my motorcycle for $500. And it works. And then the guy that buys it pays the $500 and it doesn't work and they can't resolve their dispute, then they could go to court. And in that type of case, they would be in, either one would be entitled to demand a jury, and the court would have to allow them to proceed with a jury.
I see. So it seems like it can be a very complex case. So how long typically would, actually, the word typically probably should not be used here, right? But what are we looking at in terms of the timeline for a case like this?
Well, before March 15th, 2020, I would say it could be as little as 12 months, probably closer to 14 to 16 months. But in complicated cases or in unique instances, it may be 2 years. Now, first of all, I don't really have the ability to give you an estimate because we don't even know yet, but my guess is everything will be delayed a year. So whatever.
How long would it take to get to trial? Oh, I'm sorry.
I said, whatever the old estimates were, as far as how long it takes to get a case to trial, I would add 6 months to a year. But if you can resolve it and you can get into mediation or somehow settle the case, you know, you still have that capability. The case doesn't have to last a year or two. But if you're talking about from the time you file the case until getting into an actual trial, especially a jury trial, I would say we're looking at closer to 18 to 24 months instead of 12 to 18 months.
I see. And then when the actual trial, is it typically happen in one day, or is it multiple days, or is it part of a day?
I've had trials last a day, and I've had a trial last 4.5 months. So it can be anywhere in between, depending upon how complicated the case is, how many parties are in the lawsuit. Sometimes it's not just two parties. Sometimes, you know, you have 20 parties on one side. An example is like a construction defect lawsuit where, you know, all the homeowners are suing the developer, but then the developer has contractors that did all the work. So you've got multiple parties on the plaintiff side and multiple parties on the defense side. So it really depends. Wow. And it also depends. I mean, if it's a bench trial, meaning a judge trial, you can usually get to trial faster than a jury trial. And I would say, especially now, with COVID, although they are trying some really unique things as far as having jurors potentially be remote, so the judges and the judge and the attorneys and the parties may be in court, but the jurors may be somewhere else. There's all kinds of ideas being thrown out there. So we'll see. Unfortunately, for purposes of today, I don't really have any solid information to provide on that because it's still being worked out, literally, depending on the courts. And every court is different. And in some cases, even the courtrooms in the court are different. So we have to be flexible.
Right. And then we talk about evidence. What else that is important in fighting a case like this?
Well, you have the documentary evidence, emails, letters, texts, photos, things like that. But then the witness testimony is also very important. So preparing for, if you're going to go to trial, preparing to cross-examine any adverse witnesses, preparing to have your own client testify. And sometimes your client is really good at testifying. Other times you might have a client that does not do well at all, even though you've gone over and over and over with them how the process works, that they just, for whatever reason, they don't come across well. So you have to spend more time trying to, you know, try and polish it, so to speak, so that they can, you know, accurately and articulate their position and respond to the questions. It's not necessarily an issue of them being honest or not, just some people are a little more skilled at it than others.
Actually, it's exactly the reason why we started this podcast, because I've noticed that sometimes you can be innocent, and yet when you go to court, it's not enough. And so this is exactly the point when you brought up about, you know, sometimes it's not because they're not honest, but somehow it still doesn't come across well. So what kind of advice would you have for people who are going to stand up and try to defend themselves? How can they prepare so that they look better in court or be able to portray or express themselves better?
Well, there's a lot of things. I can give you my list that I can think of off the top of my head, but I would say, you know, don't try and fudge on your testimony. Be honest, be responsive. I would say, don't volunteer any information if you're not specifically asked it. Wait for your own attorney to provide that. I would also say, listen to the question carefully. And if you're not entirely clear on what the question is, politely ask the attorney to rephrase it. The judge will always allow a witness to do that. Judges are, you know, more often than not, very friendly and protective of witnesses. So maybe practice, or at least get comfortable with the courtroom. So if you're going to testify, maybe a week or so before, go in and watch a couple of other trials and see how it works. Just the layout, to at least familiarize yourself as a witness. I would caution my witnesses not to guess. Don't speculate. You know, give your best answer. But if you're not entirely sure, then tell them, "I don't recall," or "I don't know." I would also tell witnesses and clients who testify not to fight with the other attorney. Sometimes the attorneys in court or in deposition are exceptionally rude and disrespectful. And sometimes that's on purpose to try and get the witness to get upset. Other times that's just their very nature. But regardless, I counsel all my clients and witnesses to do everything in their power to not be defensive, not fight with the other lawyer. You know, the more you fight, the longer it's going to take, first of all, so you'll be on the stand longer. But you don't want to give the trier of fact, either the judge or the jury, any impression that you're trying to hide anything. So just be yourself. Don't try and present yourself or testify in a way that you think you should. Just your personality, just be open and responsive and honest. And I would like to think that will show through.
That's very helpful. That's a great list of tips and advice. That's great. Thank you.
Well, I have a whole list somewhere. I mean, I think I have it on my website on what we have, what we give to our clients. In responding in depositions. As far as depositions are concerned, I have what I call Greg's Rule of Five, and that is simply for my clients to try and answer every question with one of five responses. And it's designed to avoid them volunteering information or getting off track, but it's answer the question yes, no, I don't know, I don't recall, and I don't understand your question. And try and do that first before you start to give any long-winded responses, because you need to make sure you're responding to the question specifically asked and you don't want to go off on a tangent trying to explain yourself, let your own attorney come back and get context or explain things, as opposed to trying to fight with the other lawyer and trying to couch all your responses in the context you want. It more often than not does not go well when you do that.
So you said yes, no, I don't recall. I don't understand your question. I think I missed one.
I don't recall or I don't know.
They oh, I don't know, similar, yes.
But I don't recall. But different. I used to know, but I don't right now. And I don't know means I just have no idea.
Oh, that's
eventually,
so great.
Eventually, let's say you answer the question, yes, no, I don't recall. Eventually, they'll ask a question like, well, tell me what you mean by that or something. And of course, you answer that question. But the default before you get into those questions is to try and keep it laser focused on yes, no, I don't recall, I don't know, or I don't understand your question. You know, and if the question is really convoluted and have multiple parts, I would try and get the attorney to break it up so it's not two or three questions in one, so that you can take a little bite size at a time, so that you're not trying to respond to three different things in one answer. Because you don't want to have a situation where the jurors or the judge may misunderstand what you're referring to. So we want to try and keep it simple.
Very cool. You talk about jury. I just thought of, the declaration that started the case, right? Somebody filed a lawsuit and they explained here is the situation. Do the jury have access to that before the case? No.
Well, yes and no. It's public record. So a lawsuit is public record unless there's some instance where it's under seal. But, you know, 99.9% of the time, a lawsuit filed and the answer to the lawsuit or a cross complaint to the lawsuit, that's all public record. Now, will the jurors go do their own homework and try and figure it out? I don't know, but it's not like we hand them the lawsuit at the beginning. But keep in mind, the lawsuit is it's not designed to have every bit of evidence in it. It's designed to put the defendant on notice, the type of claims and generally the evidence you might have supporting the claims. So, you know, there's going to be a lot more evidence and testimony and witnesses and documents besides what's in the lawsuit. I mean, the lawsuit typically doesn't even go to the jury.
So if it does go to the jury, you're going to have to assume that the jury only get to see whatever that is happening in court, right? You can't assume that they have seen something else.
Right. So, and the judge actually will caution them, you know, don't do any independent research. Don't go online and try and look at the court file to see what has happened before the case gets there. Because the idea is that the jurors are only supposed to consider the evidence, admissible evidence that comes into court. And so, you know, you hear objections and when that happens, one side believes, you know what, this isn't something that the jury is supposed to consider. And then the attorneys argue it with the judge, and then the judge ultimately makes a decision. That's what you see that even on TV with objections and whatnot. But ideally, the jurors are supposed to consider only evidence that is appropriate for them to consider in that particular instance.
I see. Okay. So we talk about evidence, we talk about witnesses. What else can we prepare to use in court?
Well, there's quite a few other things. You know, you'll probably want to have some good demonstrative evidence, which is charts and diagrams and pictures to help illustrate complicated points. So you may create literally charts and diagrams. Let's say you had a medical malpractice case or something like that. Let's say I'm defending a medical malpractice case, and some of the stuff is really technical. And, you know, let's say we're involving a hand where the tendons were not put back together. I mean, we would have medical illustrations that would show, you know, the back of a hand, and then another picture with the skin pulled back with all the tendons. So the idea is to help the jurors understand the concepts, not only understand, but remember. So it may not necessarily be a particularly complicated concept or issue, but you really want them to remember it. And I'm a firm believer in visual education and visual knowledge, that people capture a lot of their knowledge from what they see. And so I like to have testimony, but then have some type of visual for the jurors to follow along so that they remember it.
What is that called?
Very important.
That's
called demonstrative evidence. And demonstrative evidence is different than regular evidence. Demonstrative evidence is to illustrate a point. So it's not an exhibit that goes to the jury when they go to deliberate. It can be turned into an exhibit if during the trial it meets certain criteria, but ordinarily demonstrative evidence is not something that goes into court. But one of the other things you said, what do you do to prepare besides the witnesses and the evidence? And another thing is to really sit down and think about, okay, how is my case going to resonate with the jury? What's my theme? What am I trying to show big picture wise? Am I trying to portray the defendant as a greedy corporation, or am I trying to portray the plaintiff as faking injuries and you know, not entitled to any compensation? So we come up with our themes. What's this case about? Is it about right and wrong, or is it about greed, or is it about doing the right thing? All kinds of different themes, but I think it's really important to really understand what your case boils down to and then try and weave that theme throughout the case with witnesses, documents, your opening statement, your closing argument, all of that.
You're talking about the theme, and you mentioned about, you know, maybe portraying that this person is a greedy person. And then how would you avoid the opposing party object to anything you say about that as being irrelevant?
Well, it depends. So, you know, a lot of times you get the point across without really saying exactly what you're talking about. So, for example, and I'll just pick an example that comes to mind. Let's say you have a plaintiff in a car accident, and they go to the lawyer before they go to the doctor. Well, the other side, who's on the defense, they may argue that, look, what is really motivating them is money, and they weren't really that injured, or they weren't injured at all, and that this is just a money grab. Things like that. So, you know, I wouldn't call them greedy in court if I were that attorney, but you would certainly illustrate that they went to the lawyer first and then the doctor. And that's a really simple example. I'm sure there's much better than, I just can't think of it off the top of my head.
No, that's very helpful. Thank you. Okay. So different type of evidence. And then we talk about witnesses. Talking about the theme, that's really, really important, especially with a jury case, right? Because these are humans, these are people that, like it or not, they make decisions with emotions.
Well, right. And in a case, I mean, you may have your theme, but there may be certain issues that you really need to understand and figure out how you want to portray it to the jury. And I would say that you would want to begin thinking of your themes in the very beginning of a case. I don't wait till the night before my opening statement to go, gee, what kind of theme should I have? Hopefully I have already developed that. And as the case progressed, I literally keep folders in my computer of evidence that, or ideas or thoughts, or, you know, what's the best way to present my client's view of this case. If, let's say, I represent a corporation in a dispute with another corporation, I mean, it's almost like the definition of the most boring case ever known to man is two corporations fighting over a contract. So a lot of times I may not be thinking about it entirely of in the context of theme, but I'm trying to make it interesting and rememberable and understandable to the entire jury. So I know I got a little off far afield there, but we started themes.
Yeah, that's very, very helpful. Okay, so we go to court, and then this could go on in a day or it could be multiple days. And then the jury listen to everything that's going on in court, and then they go away and debate that, right? I'm taking this from TVs.
Right, right.
And how long would that typically take?
Okay, so let's say we had a breach of fiduciary duty case between a company is suing their president for embezzling or something like that, or doing things that are harmful to the company. And let's say we have five witnesses total. Okay, so the first thing we would do, we show up to court, and there may be pretrial motions where one side may say, hey, judge, the other side is going to bring in this evidence, and I don't think it's appropriate, and I don't want the jury to hear it because I can't unring the bell if you don't admit it then, but they hear about it. So I want you to address these issues ahead of time. That's the kind of the pretrial conference that the attorneys have with the judge. But then the first thing that happens is they bring in 50, 60 potential jurors into the courtroom, and we have the jury selection process, where both sides get to question all the potential jurors, exercise any peremptory challenges, which is a challenge that you can make for any reason, and then challenges for cause if you can show that the person is actually biased. And then from there, once your jury is selected, you have the opening statement where both sides tell the jury what they think the evidence is going to show in the case. And then the plaintiff goes first and calls all their witnesses. And with their witnesses, they get documents into evidence. A lot of times when the plaintiff is finished with their case, the defendant may make some motions, like a motion to dismiss or a motion for judgment or something along those lines, arguing that the case shouldn't go any further. But in most instances, if you get to trial, they'll probably survive something like that. And then the defendant puts on their case and their witnesses and their evidence. So we go through that process. And then when all the evidence has concluded, then we would address jury instructions with the court, although sometimes the courts do that early in the case. But either way, the court has to come up with what the agreed upon jury instructions, which are basically statements of the law that apply to that particular case. And so the attorneys may fight back and forth as to what particular instructions should be given. But ultimately, there'll be a final set of jury instructions. The judge will provide them to the jury either before or after closing arguments. You have the closing arguments from both sides. The plaintiff goes first, then the defendant, and the plaintiff always gets the last word. And the reason is they have the burden of proof. So if at the end of the case, things are even, the plaintiff lost. So they have to prove, usually in a civil case by a preponderance of the evidence. But since they have the burden of proof, they always get that last word. And then the jurors go in and deliberate, and they can deliberate. I've had one jury deliberate for 10 minutes, and I've had juries deliberate for days. Just depends on the complexity, the jury, all kinds of various issues. And every now and then, the jurors have questions during their deliberation, and depending on the judge, they may entertain the questions, they may not. They may bring the attorneys in and try and get a consensus on how to answer the question. It's unique to any particular judge and then what the questions are.
I see. So we mentioned about pretrial conference and then jury selection. Now, during jury selection, if I understood you correctly, you can deny a particular jury without providing reasoning, or you always have to provide reasoning?
No, you don't always have to provide reasoning. So let's say, for example, we've got a straight business dispute, breach of contract, two companies. pretty straightforward. One side on the plaintiff side, one side, one party on the defense side. Typically here in California, we both sides each get 6 peremptory challenges, which means they can challenge up to 6 people. Just say, Your Honor, we'd like to thank and excuse juror number 12. And you don't have to give a reason. You have as many challenges for cause as apply. So if someone is unable to be fair and impartial or is biased in favor of somebody, and it's established during the jury selection process to the court's satisfaction, the court will dismiss them for cause. And that doesn't count against either side's peremptory challenges. But it's a little bit of a chess game because, the potential jurors come in and the plaintiff goes first and, then the defendant as far as questioning, but then they start going back and forth on peremptory challenges. And, once you use them up, and you could be stuck with witnesses because as each juror is excused, another one comes in. And so it's this constant process. Meanwhile, your peremptory challenges are getting smaller and smaller, and so you have to use them wisely.
I see. And then you mentioned about jury instruction. What does it mean by jury instruction? What kind of things in there?
Okay. Well, so there are all kinds of jury instructions, some about how the trial went, some about specific law, and others about how to calculate damages if it's appropriate. So for example, there'll be a jury instruction where the judge reads an instruction that says, hey jury, if I said or did anything that makes you think I'm on anyone's side, ignore it. I didn't intend that. It also tells the jurors, deposition testimony came in at trial. This is what it is. It does carry the same force and effect. There's jury instructions like failure to produce available stronger evidence. So there's an instruction that says to the jury, if someone had available and stronger evidence to contradict the other side's claims and they didn't present it, then you can assume that evidence would have been harmful to them. So there's things like that to help the jurors figure out how to process the evidence and weigh the credibility of the witnesses. So it gives them tools to weigh the credibility. It also talks about different ways to look at evidence. Whether it's strong evidence or weak evidence, circumstantial evidence versus, direct evidence. But then also tells them the law. So let's say it's breach of contract or let's say personal injury. The law, was it the other party that caused the accident? Were they at fault? And you go through the elements of duty, breach, cause of the accident, and damages. And then there's also jury instructions, if there is liability found, on how the jurors are supposed to calculate the damages. So in some instances, it's really easy. It's, he was supposed to pay me $500 for the motorcycle and he didn't pay. So I need $500. But in other instances, there may be a business may say, hey, by not delivering this product, or this machine to me in a timely fashion and one that worked, I lost a ton of sales. And so I've lost profits as a result of the other side's breach of contract. And so if that particular issue is involved in the case, then the jurors would be given instructions or tools really to help them, to show them how the judge thinks the law requires that they calculate the damages.
I see. Thank you. And you mentioned a word about burden of proof is on the plaintiff and they have to prove there's a standard word that you use. I forgot.
A preponderance of the evidence.
Yeah. What does that mean?
There's basically three types of burden of proof. There's preponderance of evidence. There's clear and convincing evidence. And there's beyond a reasonable doubt. Okay. So beyond a reasonable doubt is what you see on TV, criminal cases. they have to prove, the prosecutor has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did this crime or whatever. In a civil case, it's by a preponderance of the evidence. So if it's 50-50, the plaintiff didn't meet their burden. But if it's 51-49, then that's a preponderance. It's just a little bit over 50-50 that the plaintiff has to prove to the jury or the judge that the defendant is responsible for the wrongful conduct or the breach or whatnot. Now, there are some types of claims that in civil case that require a little bit more than a preponderance, what we call clear and convincing evidence. And that's in between preponderance and beyond a reasonable doubt. And certain instances like that include, say, a fraud claim and punitive damages. So to award punitive damages, which are damages that are not necessarily related to the wrongdoing, but are designed to punish the wrongdoer, those require, to find someone liable for punitive damages, the plaintiff has to prove by clear and convincing evidence, a higher burden of proof for that, as opposed to, say, negligence or a breach of fiduciary duty, straight claims like that. It's preponderance of the evidence, but punitive damages and some other specific select types of claims or cases require clear and convincing evidence in the civil arena. Again, criminal, it's beyond a reasonable doubt.
So what about lawyer's fee? Does that fall into the punitive? How does it work?
No, it doesn't. And I'm actually, that's a great question that you brought up, because in business cases, a lot of times the attorney's fees are as big of an issue as anything else. Okay. And so, and the reason I bring that up is without a contract, the contractual provision in a contract saying the prevailing party in a lawsuit will get their attorney's fees, or without a specific statute that allows for the recovery of attorney's fees. If you don't have those, then neither party gets their attorney's fees. So the winner may spend, X amount of dollars on their attorney's fees and recover what they were entitled to. But, the net is reduced by the amount of attorney's fees they had to pay. So in business cases, having an attorney fee provision in a contract or other entitlement is a really big leverage item, because if I represent the plaintiff and there's an attorney fee provision, when I'm trying to convince the other side, hey, we should settle, it's because I think I'm going to win and they will be responsible to pay my client's attorney's fees, plus they have to pay their own attorney's fees. So it's a bit of a double whammy, which just makes it riskier to not settle. So it helps provide leverage in some instances for both sides, in other instances on one side, to try to settle sooner rather than later, because the attorney's fees will increase over time, and especially once you get to the trial. But then there's a risk that the loser could pay their own attorneys and the winner's attorney's fees.
So it's a very wise advice.
That's one of the first things we always look at in business litigation cases, is to see if the plaintiff, whether it's my client or the other side, whether they would be entitled under the law to recover attorney's fees.
So for someone who's not a business, it's important to make sure they have that provision in their contract now before they get into a situation of litigation.
Yes, but keep in mind it is a double-edged sword. So there are some when don't want attorney's fee provisions, okay? So let's say Coca-Cola is entering into a contract with a mom-and-pop shop down the street. Well, Coca-Cola may not want attorney's fees provisions because they think that they can absorb the attorney's fees easier than someone else with limited means. And so it's a factor to consider in all of your contracts, but I would not say that in every instance you want to have that. There are some instances where you don't want to have it, but at least analyze it and decide.
Oh, very good. And then when it comes to choosing a lawyer, what would you advise someone, like what to look out for, what kind of question to ask?
Well, I guess if we're talking about a lawyer for business litigation, you would want somebody that is sufficiently experienced in handling business litigation cases, breach of contract, fraud, breach of fiduciary duty, shareholder derivative actions, things like, you know, what is their track record? Have they had success in that area? One thing is, if you think the case may go to trial, have the lawyers, they have experience in trial, or better yet, are they members of the American Board of Trial Advocates, or are they board certified trial specialists? Those two items are particularly difficult for an attorney to obtain. It takes a lot of time and effort, but it shows their experience in handling trials. You know, you want an attorney that is both knowledgeable but responsive and gets things done. Ideally, in business litigation cases, they can be expensive. And so, you know, you want an attorney that can be prepared if you go to trial, but also one that is capable of settling the case if that's what the client wants, and try and avoid incurring a lot of attorney's fees, especially if there are risks related to attorney's fees, like I just said. So I think, you know, meet them, make sure you're comfortable with them, ask questions and make sure that they answer the questions that you ask. You know, talk to other people that may have worked with the attorneys. And ultimately, you just need to feel comfortable with them. But what you're looking for is someone that has the ability, the experience, and the knowledge, but is also responsive and proactive to get the case resolved one way or another. Get it resolved via settlement, or get it into trial and get it over with at trial. So that's kind of, I think I did a video on that years ago when we first started doing videos on our websites. So I probably look a lot different, but I think I did it a long time ago on what to look for in hiring a lawyer.
Maybe we'll look for that video and link it to the show notes. What about the lawyer fee structure? Is it typically a retainer and then hourly, or how does it work? Or is it contingency?
Okay, for, you know, contingency cases are for the most part for personal injury cases. And lawyers take personal injury cases, auto accidents, on contingency all day, every day. Because more often than not, there's always insurance. And so that means they're going to get paid or later if they're successful. Business litigation, though, is different because there isn't an insurance company usually. Sometimes there is, but for the most part, there isn't. And both sides have to be attorneys and potentially be responsible for the other side's attorney's fees. And usually there isn't a contingency. Cases don't lend themselves to contingency because even if it was, you know, some type of case that you might think might be a contingency, like defamation or something like that, in a business dispute, they're guaranteed that the other side will have money to pay for your client. And so that's why, for the most part, you'll rarely ever see attorneys handling litigation cases on a contingency. So it's a retainer and then an hourly rate, typically. You know, sometimes if there's a lot of volume in certain type cases, so if someone is doing, you know, contract cases for a big, they're doing thousands of them, you know, they may have certain flat fees or graduated steps to as far as charges for certain elements of a case. But I would say, you know, most often it's a straight hourly rate, depending on, you know, how long the case takes.
Thank you so much. I think we've covered a lot of information. Is there something important that I did not ask?
Oh, wow. I don't know. I think we covered a lot. I can't think of anything. You caught me tongue-tied without anything to say.
Thank you so much for tuning in. If you have any questions or suggestions, please let us know. And if you find value from our program, please subscribe, share, and leave a review.
Please note that the discussions here are not intended to substitute for legal advice. Please seek the advice and help from a lawyer regarding any legal matters.